Today's Teisho will be on case 37 in the Heikigan Roku, the Pien Lu, the Blue Cliff Record, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 37 is entitled Banzan's Three Worlds No Dharma. Engo's Introduction. The spirit which moves like lightning you fail to follow. When the bolt descends from the blue, you have no time to cover your ears. The scarlet banner flutters over the master's head. The two-edged sword is being brandished behind the student's neck. Unless your eyes are sharp and your hands move quickly, how can you cope with the situation? One will lower his head and ponder, following the delusive ways of thought. Don't you know that countless skulls are haunted by ghosts? I want to ask you, without falling into the delusive way of thinking, and without halting irresolutely, how can you respond to the teacher's words? See the following. Main subject, Banzan said to his disciples, in the three worlds there is no Dharma. Where could you find the mind? Secho's verse, three worlds, no Dharma. Where could you find the mind? White clouds crown the heavens. The streams draw music from the harp. Tunes and harmonies which none can understand. The night's rain has brought the autumn waters deep. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. I just got back from a trip out west to see my family in Albuquerque, some members of my family in Albuquerque, and also to do some hiking in southern Colorado and northern New Mexico. I was staying in a motel one night and looking through the tourist brochures and magazines that were in the hotel. And if you look at the tourist magazines and you look at the tourist brochures, they have pictures of people doing various things like whitewater rafting through the Grand Canyon, or hiking through, say, Glen Canyon. Or they have pictures also from places that aren't in the Southwest, people strolling along a beach, maybe in Cancun. You know, and when we look at those pictures, in a certain way, you know, we want to have that experience, right? You know, it's part of the function of the tourist magazine to make you want to have a certain kind of experience. And so it will show, one of the tourist magazines showed people, we were staying in Taos, which is a great little town if you ever have the chance. And please, it's great to be a tourist in Taos. If you go, I recommend the Taos Diner. Very good. The tourist magazine had a picture of people eating at one of the restaurants in Taos, and you know, it was very nice atmosphere, candles, and very New Mexican adobe walls. When you look at the picture, you want to have that experience. So you see the picture of somebody whitewater rafting through the Grand Canyon, something I've never done, but which would undoubtedly be a lot of fun. Or hiking through the Grand Canyon, which I have actually done. Or dining in Taos, which I have actually done, you know. And you see the pictures and you say, I want to have, consciously or unconsciously, want to have that experience. And there's different ways to have that experience. You know, one way to have that experience is to go rafting down the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon, and at the end to say, I've done it. I've finally had that experience. And now I can check that off my bucket list. Or you can go to dinner in Taos and you can have the picture in your mind and you can say, I finally had dinner in Taos. I can check that off my list. This is really actually very important because we think that our desires and our thoughts are ours, you know. But actually, a great deal of what we desire and what we experience is pre-programmed by our culture, right? The culture is sort of telling us what to want and how the experience should be. The good news is that there's more to experience than what the culture tells us. You might go to a hotel dining room in Taos, and it's too crowded, right? You have the picture in your mind of fine dining at this Taos hotel, but you get there and it's too crowded. So then you go down the street to maybe a place to eat that's not as exotic. But you are there with friends. Maybe there's a thunderstorm coming up. The thunderstorm comes up and you can hear the crashing of the thunder and the lightning outside. You see the torrential rain. Sometimes deserts get these torrential monsoon-like rains. And maybe the food is good, even though it's sort of more like a diner than a restaurant. On your dying day, you might remember that experience. Or you decide that you need to cross the whitewater rafting trip down the Colorado and the Grand Canyon off your bucket list. So you do the trip. But the trip turns out to be nothing like the magazine image of it, right? Maybe you're on a raft with people who argue the whole time. This has happened, right? I've been on hikes with people I don't know, and they're arguing the whole time. You want to just jump off the mountain, right? Or push them off the mountain, which Buddhists are not allowed to do. It's definitely the case that things might not turn out the way they're supposed to. Basically, they're having a drought, and you get to the spring on the map, and there's no spring. So you don't have any water, you can't cook. Maybe you wind up eating a Cliff Bar for dinner, this sort of thing. Or bear breaks into the supplies, these things happen, right? Along the way, along the trip, you didn't dress properly, it gets too cold, you didn't expect it to get cold at night. You can't sleep, you're in your sleeping bag, but you're too cold. So you get up and you go out of the tent and you look up and you see the stars overhead. And you're far from any city and you can see this dazzling display of the constellations. And suddenly you think, it's so good to be alive, so good to be alive. I'm so grateful for my life, right? So, our culture gives us images of how reality should be. Your trip is supposed to look like this. You go to Taos and you have fine dining at the Taos Inn. But you don't get into the Taos Inn. You go down the street to the Taos Diner and you have this wonderful conversation with the people you met hiking. And you have basically enchiladas, you know, which are nothing fancy, but they're delicious, you know. And you watch the torrential rain fall out of the sky, and you remember that all your life. It has nothing to do with the image you saw. Or you go down the Colorado River, and what you remember isn't even the river. You know, you remember the stars in the sky, the biting cold, right? And then that just desire to thank the universe for your existence. And, you know, the river might be an afterthought. Maybe you make a friend on the trip. You know, it's like, yeah, it's another day on the river, but what really, you can't wait to get to the sandbar to have a conversation with your new friend. You know, so you know, our culture gives us cliches. So much of what we think and so much of what we want is a cliché. You know, if you don't know that word cliché, a cliché is an expression like, my father used to say, that's hotter than a little red wagon, meaning very hot. And in the 1930s and 40s in the New York area, that was actually like a cliché for very hot. You know, I don't know what a little red wagon is, you know, or what a little red wagon and why it would be hot, but it's a cliché. If you say, you know, the early bird gets the worm, you know, that's a cliché. Everybody knows it's like, you, if somebody else could finish your sentence, the early bird, and somebody else could say, gets the worm, see? It's a cliché. It feels like it's ours, it's in our head. But it was probably invented by Shakespeare or somebody like that, and it's just rattling around in our heads. So a lot of our lives are like that. You know, we are supposed to be having a certain kind of experience that somebody told us we should have. Primarily, the American tourist industry, right? But you know, the more we're trying to have the experience that we're supposed to have, the less open we are to what's actually happening. See? And this is a very important aspect of life and Zen practice, you know. That when you know, the culture gives you pictures, you're supposed to see yourself in the Grand Canyon, on the rubber raft, your paddle in hand, your life preserver on, and your face is contorted with, you know, excitement, right? You know, but you get on the river, maybe there's not, you know, it's been a drought, it's kind of sluggish, you know, you're just paddling along, and it's hot as hell down there, it could be 120 degrees. So maybe you realize you went at the wrong time, but you know, then there's something about those nights where you look at the stars, or something about your friend. So, you know, the experience is more than the picture of it you're supposed to have, right? So the culture says, you know, your life is supposed to be like this. You know, but sometimes your life turns out to be very different from that. And if you're alert, if you're willing to set the picture aside and have the experience, it could be wonderful. You know, so one way to take the Grand Canyon trip is to just say, I'm supposed to be having a good time on the river. And, you know, every day you're measuring it against that picture of the people in their life preservers, white water splashing about them, you know, sitting around a campfire at night, and nothing that's happening is coinciding with those images, and you can get more and more depressed. You can say, oh, this is a terrible trip, you know, it's just not measuring up, I was told that we were supposed to have fun on this trip, you know, why am I not having fun? You know, if you put aside the expectations of what's supposed to be happening, all these wonderful things are happening, right? All these wonderful things are happening, just not the things you expected. And the problem is, you know, it takes a certain kind of openness or a certain kind of security not to go along with what you've been told should be happening. You know, so you know, a lot of us are insecure about our own experience. We expect things to coincide with what we've been told they should be. And when they don't coincide or they don't fit the bill, we get nervous and worried, like something's wrong with us. See, this is part of our conditioning as human beings. We're raised, you know, we're raised to have great respect for, you know, our elders, the wisdom of our society, and we're also raised, you know, we're raised watching, you know, most people in my generation watch thousands and thousands of hours of television, right? So, you know, on television when I was growing up, there were these shows like Father Knows Best. I'm sure most of you have never seen this show. Father Knows Best, or, there was a number of them, but the point is, you know, Leave It to Beaver. You probably never seen Leave It to Beaver, you know. These were shows about family life, and, you know, my family could never fit that bill. You know, so I remember as a teenager feeling like I was always bitterly disappointed that my family wasn't like the families on TV, you know. The family on TV, the parents, the father was always walking around the house in his sweater. He had a check shirt and a sweater, a cardigan sweater, and when his son would have a difficulty, the son would go to his dad and ask him, and the dad always had some words of wisdom, right? And the mother was always patient and kind, and my parents were nothing like that. I remember once I was having trouble with algebra. And I went to my father and I said, "Dad, I failed my algebra test." And my father, he didn't go, "Oh, don't worry, you'll get it." He flipped out. "What? You failed your algebra test? You know, you're not studying." And then I said, "I can't figure this out." And he looked at the book. He started trying to do the problems, and he got so absorbed. He was in the problems for like half an hour. And finally, he was furious. I think he threw the book on the bed or something. You know, he said, "Ask your teacher." You know, he couldn't solve them himself, right? Well, that's not what happened in the TV show, right? You know, the father on the TV show would have said, "Well, Beaver, let me see." And he'd have figured it out. See, it's just like this. Next day, Beaver would have gone to class, and he would have gotten this better grade and a big smile. At the end of all the shows on TV, all the families laugh. Never, you know, it was never like, I was always bitterly disappointed that my family was so crazy. People argued all the time. It was, some of it was quite unhealthy, actually. But on the other hand, you know, I've gotten to know other families too, and they're more like my family than the TV families. You know, lots of families argue, you know, and if you stop comparing your family to the family on TV, you begin to realize, you know, actually, the people in my family are somewhat crazy, but they're actually very interesting and intelligent, and in their own screwed up way, very kind, actually, you know. You know, we have these images of how reality is supposed to be, the perfect vacation. You know, the perfect vacation is supposed to be you go to the Taos Inn and you're seated and the waiter gives you a menu and you say, what would you recommend? And you have what's on the menu, it's delicious, you know, and then that doesn't work out. You go to the Taos Diner and something wonderful happens. But if we're clinging too much, we can say, "Oh, my trip to Taos was terrible. I had my heart set on the Taos Diner. They couldn't fit us in. You know, we had to eat at the Taos Inn. We had to eat at this diner, blah, blah, blah." You know, so if you have an expectation and things don't go with the expectation and you cling to the expectation, this is a formula for unhappiness. And it's also not wisdom, right? Wisdom means you can step outside of that picture that you've been told is what should be happening. You can always step outside of the picture. See, this is such an important lesson. The main subject of this koan is Bonzan said to his disciples, in the three worlds there is no Dharma. Where can you find the mind? Now, we often think of Dharma as meaning Buddhism, right? Buddhism. More generally, in Indian thinking, Dharma has a broader meaning as like order or pattern or law, right? Like law, like natural law. Dharma has this element of natural law or intrinsic order, right? So Bonzan says, in the three worlds of time, there is no intrinsic order. There is no pattern, universal order, universal pattern. See? And the three worlds of time, he says the three worlds, but he means the three worlds of time, past, present, and future. So, you know, another way to think about this is, you know, we're always looking for the Dharma. You know, whether we're Buddhists or not, we're always looking for, there's an order or a natural way or a way to be, right? You know, when I was watching those TV shows in the 60s and the 70s of Father Knows Best, the patient father comes home and lights his pipe and offers advice to his children, and they all listen like he has something interesting to say. You know, that's Dharma. That's like the universal order. Fathers are supposed to be good and wise. Mothers are supposed to be kind and infinitely patient, right? Children are supposed to be, you know, cheerful and a little funny, right? And always energetic and happy, right? No family is really like that. No family on earth is really like that. You know? Fathers often don't know what they're doing. Mothers are often so harried, they aren't always infinitely patient and kind, you know? So if we're looking for the perfect order, we miss what is actually happening, which is much more interesting. You know. So Bonzan says, in the three worlds, there is no Dharma. Where would you find the mind? And this is really important. You know, if people get nothing else out of Buddhism, it's that, you know, The order we are expecting is not the order. In Chinese tradition, there's a wonderful... The Tao that can be named is not the Tao. So Tao is like a little bit like Dharma in Indian culture. Tao is the natural way. See, and the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching says the great way... He says... the Tao that can be named is not the real Tao. So the structure you imagine is not really the structure of the universe. The order you believe is present is not the real order. Humans create imaginary orders, imaginary worlds, and they try to make them real. And when they try to make them real, they become ill. They become unhappy. You know, in Seattle, one of the things my teacher liked to do, my second teacher, Webb Roshi, was to hold tea ceremonies at the Japanese Garden in the Arboretum in Seattle. And I have spent a lot of time doing Japanese tea ceremony, tsado, myself. And I spent a lot of time in the Arboretum in Seattle and at the Japanese Garden. And the Japanese Garden is a marvel. Because, you know, when you, everywhere you look, it's like a picture. It's so perfect. You know, so when you come into the garden, there's a little pond or a little small lake. And around the lake are plants that are about 3 feet, 2 to 3 feet high, some evergreens and some short bamboo. And then, you know, if you look beyond the pond and the little plants around it, there's higher plants, like a Japanese maples and some rhododendrons. And then beyond that, there are some even taller trees. And when you look at it, you instantly feel relaxed and harmonious, right? And people who go there say, oh, how beautiful. It's so natural. So natural. You know, the thing about the Japanese is they love nature. They love nature. You know, but actually, if you go to the Japanese garden in Seattle after hours, it's shocking. Because there's all these gardeners there, and they're pulling out dead plants, putting in live plants. They have weed whackers. They actually, until they were made to stop, they were even using Roundup, right, to get rid of the weeds, so it would have a totally natural look, right? Do you see where I'm going? You know, when you look at the Japanese garden, it says nature. But you know, nature isn't like that. You know, nature is crazy and spontaneous, right? And there is order, but it's always in flux. It's always like an emerging order. And it's never static and complete. You know, so the Japanese garden is a picture of nature we hold in our minds. But the real nature isn't like that, you know? Nature is a lot more complicated than that. You come to little spots, you know, when we were hiking, we went up this beautiful valley, up through this beautiful falls trail. It was a trail that followed this waterfall up into the Collegiate Mountains of Colorado. And it was absolutely beautiful, but you know, when you get to the top, it's like sheer rock, and that hike through that sheer rock is really difficult. You know, so yes, there are places that look like Japanese garden, but there are other places that look like the moon, right? Very inhospitable, very difficult. So, you know, it's more complicated than the Japanese garden. The Japanese garden is our image of nature. If you go hiking and you're looking for scenes that look like a Japanese garden, you will find them occasionally, but most of the scenes you see won't look like that. And if you're disappointed, you're holding on to a mental image you need to get rid of. And the fact is, we can always step out of these pictures because we humans have this power. We have this power to step outside of the three worlds. And the way we do it in Zen is to practice meditation and on emptiness, right? Mu Shin, Wu Shin. You know, so, you know, you sit down on the cushion. Let's say you're in your job. And your idea is that you're going to write this report, and it's brilliant. And you write the report, and you're thinking, this is the best report I've ever done. You know, this is the best report I've ever written. And my ideas are so brilliant. You know, when my boss sees this, he's going to go, you know, Kurt, you know, I've got to promote you right away, right? And you know, maybe they really are brilliant ideas. It's like if people listen to these ideas, you know, things will be different around here. And you give it to your boss, and the boss goes, oh, I don't know. I don't think I like this plan. You know, and you spent 2 weeks on this proposal. Maybe you like working, you know, long, you know, 16-hour days or something. So you come here and you sit down on the cushion and you can't let it go. You know, it wasn't supposed to, the picture in your mind was that the boss is supposed to read this and go, you're a goddamn genius, you know. I'm promoting you, right? I'm putting you in charge of the whole division, right? But instead, the guy says, I don't think so. You know, this doesn't seem very original to me. You know, I mean, this has actually happened to me. I have a job where I have to do proposals, I remember sending something up to the dean at the time, and she sent back and said, I was hoping we could have more original ideas or something like that. So we've all been there, right? And by the way, I thought my plan was great. I didn't necessarily think it was brilliant, but I thought it was pretty good. So, you know, you come in and you sit down on the cushion, and you watch your breath until you enter samadhi, the stabilization of your attention, right? Instead of your mind being all over the place like a monkey, right? See, the monkey sees this and goes to that. Then the monkey sees something else and drops what he has and goes to that. And then he drops that and goes to the next. After a while, the monkey mind is gone and you enter samadhi. It's a more stable kind of consciousness. The thoughts don't necessarily disappear, but there's fewer of them. And it's like breath and thought. And you feel different. You can feel when you're entering samadhi. It's like wading into the pool, and you can feel the weight of the water around your body. And then, you know, you sit in samadhi and you begin to call mu. Or you watch your breath, and you follow mu out until it's gone and your mind becomes blank, right? And you sit in that blankness. And, you know, after a while, you begin to feel better. You know, you begin to feel clean and unobstructed, right? So you know, when we're trying to make our life fit the images in our mind, we feel trapped when life goes in a different direction, right? We feel trapped. And people can feel so hopeless. You know, you can feel so, it's like, my God, I spent 3 weeks on that proposal. And, you know, and I put my heart and soul into that thing, and I gave it to my boss, and he just went, no, I don't think so. And it's like, you feel paralyzed, you feel trapped, right? And you sit down on the cushion, and you watch your breath, and you get into samadhi, and then you begin to enter emptiness. And suddenly all of that falls away. And you feel this tremendous sense of liberation. This can happen. This happens all the time if you practice Zen. And then, you know, eventually, you know, these things that bothered you so much are like clouds blowing by in the sky. The blue sky mind. In Japanese, ao zo. Lan tian. Blue sky mind, right? Lan tian xin. Blue sky mind. None of this is real. And none of this matters. I have a bigger mind than this. See? And you realize, okay, fine, he didn't like my proposal. I'm not going to throw myself off a cliff. What can I do right now? What can I do? You know, what can I do? And, you know, once you go through that transformation, you're liberated. It's because humans have no essential self. We have no essential self that we can liberate ourselves in this way. See, culture tells us we have an essential self. It says, you are this. You should be that, right? So, you know, but actually, you know, we have no essential self. Fundamentally, you know, there's a wonderful, wonderful sutra, if you ever have a chance to read it. And I highly recommend it. It was very popular in the Zen tradition, and especially in Chinese Chan tradition. It's the Wima Sutra, the Vimalakirti, Vimalakirti Sutra. Vimalakirti Sutra. You know, I highly recommend that sutra. It's so wonderful, you know, because it's all about the power to step outside of any reality that boxes us in, because we have no essential self. You know, the hero of the sutra is a Vaishali businessman named Vimalakirti. And the interesting thing is that even though he's a busy businessman, and he's a merchant, right, and he's got a lot going on, and he actually he's married, he has a family, but he's deeply awake. And the sutra opens up with the news reaches the Buddha that Vimalakirti is not well. He's unwell. And the Buddha has his disciples with him, and he says, "I want you to go to visit Vimalakirti and see how his health is." And each of the disciples says, each of the arhats or the bodhisattvas says, "I would rather not visit him, because the last time I met him, he corrected my understanding of the Dharma." So basically the point is, each person he asks is a great bodhisattva, a great arhat. But when they met Vimalakirti, his understanding of liberation was even deeper than theirs. And so in one case after another, say Manjushri or Subhuti, they're teaching, and then even Manjushri, who is the bodhisattva of wisdom, is offering a teaching to a crowd of people. And after the teaching, Vimalakirti comes up and says, "Manjushri, even though you're the bodhisattva of wisdom, you know, you could have done a better job," and corrects him, right? And the guy, and Manjushri says, "And damn it, he was right. You know, I didn't fully understand what I was saying about human freedom." So, you know, one after another of these very deeply awakened people decline. It's like, "I'm scared to meet with him, Buddha, because he's so deeply awake." And finally, they, you know, the whole group of them go to see Vimalakirti in his house in Vaishali. And we're told that, you know, there's some miraculous elements to this story. You know, there's like 8,000 followers of the Buddha to go into this little room, and somehow they all miraculously fit, right? And you can say, well, it's just a miracle, but it's making a point, right, that reality is flexible, more flexible than we think, because the reality never corresponds to our mental images of it, right? You can say, you'd never get 8,000 bodhisattvas in this room, but they all get in comfortably. You know, and the secret of Vimalakirti is that he knows how to get out of any mental picture that makes him feel trapped. Because humans have no essential nature. I get a paycheck from the state of New Jersey every 2 weeks, for which I am infinitely grateful, I have to tell you. And I get that check, and on the check it says Kurt Spellmeyer, you know? And actually, it goes into, I don't really get that anymore, now I have direct deposit, but it used to be like that. I live in a house in Plainfield, 1322 Martin Avenue. That's my house. If somebody says, "Is that your house?" I'll say, "Yes, that's my house." No, I have an office on College Avenue. But those are merely the pictures. That's not the reality of who I am. And it's not the reality of who you are. You know, I play many roles. Roles. R-O-L-E-S. Right? When I'm in my teaching, when I'm teaching English, I'm Professor Spellmeyer. Right? And I have to be a professor. I can't come in and say, I have no idea what Shakespeare meant. I have to pretend that I know everything about William Shakespeare if I'm teaching. I used to teach Shakespeare. And I used to pretend that I knew everything. Oh, I think Shakespeare means this. You know, I really don't know because he's dead, right? When I'm, you know, basically a dutiful brother to my sister, I don't put on my professor's hat. I put on my brother's hat, you know? And we have coffee and laugh about something that happened in my childhood and, you know, and so on and so on. When I'm with my family in my, you know, my in-laws in Albuquerque, you know, I have a different hat. Those are my roles. You know, but, you know, there's this role and this role and this role, and they're a little bit like the father on those TV shows, the guy who goes around in the cardigan with wise advice smoking his pipe. See, they're not who we really are. We all have to play roles, right? When I'm a professor, I can't wear my, I can't go into the English class and pull my legs up in the lotus posture, right? I will lose my job, you know. My job is to talk about reading and writing or talk about literature. And I will play that role there. You know, when I'm in another place, I play a different role. When I'm with old friends that I haven't seen in 40 years, I play a different role. But which of those is, it's really absurd to say, which of those is your real self? Right? Which of those is your real self? And some people really say, well, you know, my real self is the person I was at 13, but I actually think that person is boxing himself in, you know. None of those are my real self. You know, I believe, on the basis of my experience of meditation on the cushion, that my real self is like Lan Tian Xin, blue sky, Ao Zhou, blue sky mind, right? My real self is luminous and empty and adaptable to all situations without exception. And, you know, if you discover this self, you find you have a power to respond to circumstances. You know, nothing can paralyze you or box you in. Nothing can make you feel defeated. You know, we all have moments where we feel paralyzed and boxed in, or moments where we feel thoroughly defeated. You know, but if you can sit down on the cushion and enter that emptiness, you eventually reach this place where there are no obstacles. Gain and loss, right and wrong, such thoughts must finally be abolished at once. You know, there, all of that's just a TV show. Reality is different. And you're different too. You're not Bob or Bill. You're not 42 or 51. Or 23, your age, there's a part of you that is 23, and that is Bob. But your essential self is empty like the blue sky. People have no essential self, and that is why they can be free in any situation if they practice liberation starting on the cushion. And somebody like Wenshu, I'm sorry, somebody like Vimalakirti, Wima is his Chinese name, Wima, somebody like Wema or Vimalakirti is able to do anything, go anywhere and accomplish anything because he knows that he's like the blue sky. Engo's introduction, the spirit which moves like lightning you fail to follow if you cling to the images. So you go to the restaurant in Taos and you want to go to the Taos Inn, and it's full, and you're dejected and pissed off, and you go back to your hotel room and say, well, this is a bust, right? See, the spirit which moves like lightning, you fail to follow. But then instead of getting pissed off at not getting a seat at the Tao Zen, you look around. You say, well, what else is on offer here in this little town? You talk to somebody on the street and they say, the Tao Zen, forget it. Go to the Tao's diner. You go to this diner and there's formica countertop, tables with formica, and it's the best meal you have in New Mexico. You know, and the storm comes up and you remember it all your life. That's the spirit which moves. When the bolt descends from the blue, you have no time to cover your ears. See? Because you're looking at how things should be, who you should be, instead of what's the living unfolding of things right now. The Tao is unfolding right now. The scarlet banner flutters over the master's head. The two-edged sword is being brandished behind the student's neck. Unless your eyes are sharp and your hands move quickly, how can you cope with constant change? One will lower his head and ponder, following delusive ways of thought. So you know, if you try to think it through, even your thoughts are cliches, right? Even your thoughts are cliches, actually, right? So there's a deeper way of responding to situations. You know, trying to think things through is good sometimes, you know, but sometimes it's obsessive. You know, so if, let's say, you throw a party, and you invite guests you think are going to get along, but when you seat them, and you seat them thinking they'll get along, but they don't get along. They don't talk to each other, or they argue. You know, and you can think, oh, my dinner party was a wreck. You know, I put Bill next to Susan, and as it turns out, you know, Bill is a Republican, and Susan is a socialist, and they argued, and, you know, it was a disaster. Then you can lie in bed and think, why did I do that? Why didn't I I knew that he was a socialist, or I knew that he was a Republican. Why did I, you know, you can torment yourself. You know, so thinking things through is sometimes useful. But often we think obsessively. We get into these loops and we can't get out, right? There's another way. Don't you know that countless skulls are haunted by ghosts? When you're judging your experience by what should be what happening, you're going down the Grand Canyon and you have that image in your mind of how things should be, your skull is haunted by ghosts. You're living out the dead dreams of somebody else. Don't waste your life doing that. Live your own life. See, and live your own life by becoming empty and harmonizing yourself with the Tao as it unfolds. Don't you know that countless skulls are haunted by ghosts? I want to ask you, without falling into the delusive way of thinking and without halting irresolutely, how can you respond to the teacher's words? Ushin, ushin, shunyata, shunyata, shunyata. Banzan said to his disciples, in the three worlds there is no order. No order that corresponds to our tiny little mind's image of order. Where could you find the mind? Setcho's verse, three worlds, no Dharma. Where could you find the mind? White clouds crowd the heavens. The streams draw music from the heart. Tunes and harmonies which none can understand. The night's rain has brought autumn waters deep. See, the world is bigger than our cliches, our ideas of what should be happening. So to follow the Zen way is to cultivate Ushin, Shunyata, and then to live in Lan Tian Xin, blue sky mind.